How does a teenage trafficking victim end up facing more than 5 decades behind bars? That's the story of Centoya Brown, whose 51-year sentence reignited the debate over the treatment of young women of color in our criminal justice system. Brown was just 16 when she shot and killed a 43-year-old man who solicited her for sex. She was tried as an adult in Tennessee, convicted of murder, and sentenced to life behind bars in 2006. Her legal team challenged that sentence as unconstitutional, pointing to a 2012 Supreme Court ruling that protects most juveniles from life sentences without parole. But last week, a Tennessee Supreme Court ruled that Brown won't be eligible for release until she's served 51 years. I spoke about Brown's case with Marsha Levick, the chief legal officer at Juvenile Law Center, and Jeree Thomas, the policy director with the Campaign for Youth Justice.
It is deeply upsetting that it wasn't recognized that she was a teenager. She was underage and being solicited for sex. My organization, along with a number of organizations, truly believe there's no such thing as a teenage prostitute. This is a young girl who should not have been solicited in this way. I do believe that she felt it was self-defense. If you listen to her describing the situation, she was in fear for her life. She believed that the man had, well, she knew that he had many guns, that he was a sharp shooter in the military, and she believed that he was going to harm her that night. But unfortunately, that belief wasn't really taken into consideration, I feel, to the extent that it should have been.
Marsha, I want to bring you in here. If you could give us a sense of the Supreme Court decision that could provide a backdrop here and how Brown's legal team has been using that to argue for her release unsuccessfully.
Sure. The United States Supreme Court, in a series of decisions that began in 2005 and then continued through 2016, essentially addressed sentencing for children who are being prosecuted and sentenced in the adult criminal justice system. And relying on our Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, the Supreme Court not only banned the death penalty, but also banned life without parole sentences for children convicted of homicide, in particular, mandatory life sentences. And what has happened in the wake of those decisions is that we have seen a kind of, I think, toying with the decision's mandate in the sense that while courts are not, in fact, imposing life without parole sentences on many children across the country convicted of homicide, they are imposing virtual life sentences on those individuals. And by that, of course, it's exactly what we see in Centoya's case. To impose a 50-year sentence on someone, a 40-year sentence, or even higher, 60, 70-year sentences on young people as they go into prison, we are dooming them, if not necessarily to die in prison, we are creating a scenario where they will likely come out of prison on a stretcher, or they will come out of prison with very little quality life experience left for them.
I also want to bring up the issue that I think is quite obvious in this conversation, which is race and gender. Centoya was a 16-year-old woman of color, and we know from federal data that women, girls of color, are disciplined more harshly in school, for example. I'm wondering if either of you could give me a sense of how race plays into her case specifically. And the reason why I'm asking this is because I think about more recent rape cases, for example, Jeffrey Epstein. I think about Brock Turner. I think about Jacob Anderson. These are all white men who, while are not being convicted of murder, their sentencing for, you know, sex crimes has been quite light to nil. So how does race play into this?
It's impossible to have any conversation about our justice system in this country without confronting race and racism. And the system is largely populated by men and women, young women and young men of color, whether they are black or brown. And that legacy, the legacy of racism, slavery, white supremacy in this country has created a system that has, I think, frankly, become untenable in a constitutional democracy to tolerate the degree to which we have ravaged, I think, communities of color in this country.
Jeree, any thoughts on that, the racial disparities?
Yes. So I would add, again, when you mentioned that, you know, historically, there has been this issue of Black youth and brown youth being disproportionately impacted by the system. That's absolutely what we see in the data. So in 2016, Black youth were about 14% of the population, but 51.9% of the youth who were transferred by juvenile court judges in our country. And so we see the disproportionality in the number of young people being transferred to the adult system. We also see it in the types of sentences that the young people receive. So according to the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, they have a new report in which they find that 72% of the children sentenced to life without parole sentences since the Miller decision by the Supreme Court have been Black children. So Marcia was absolutely correct. There isn't really a way to disentangle the issue of Black and brown children being disproportionately negatively impacted by the adult criminal justice system.
Marcia, does Centoya have any legal recourse at this point? And more broadly, are there other changes that our legal system needs to make to improve so that we don't see more Centoya Browns happening?
With respect to her legal options right now, there is a clemency petition that has been presented to the governor of Tennessee, and there has been quite a bit of public support that has been expressed through social media, hoping that that clemency petition will be favorably reviewed. I think that what her case represents to me, when I think about both her own personal circumstances and other Centoyas out there, is that we need a new punishment paradigm in this country, and we need a new paradigm for how we deal with offending by young men and women and boys and girls. And I think what's important is that to the extent that we imagine our justice system is about both holding individuals accountable and promoting public safety, these are two legitimate goals of any justice system. The sentence imposed on Centoya, what she is confronting and facing right now, absent intervention, is one that serves neither of those purposes. She is not a risk. She is no longer a risk. The time to protect the public through her incarceration has long since passed. And she's been held accountable. She's surely been held accountable, having spent the number of years in prison that she has already spent there. And what we hope, and I think Cherie and I, working in this field, we are constantly confronted, unfortunately, with stories like Centoya's, and we are ever hopeful that this will be the one. This will be the one that will make us reevaluate, that will make us sit up and say, no, this can't be. But again, that's my hope here, that the specter of a 16-year-old girl facing 51 years in prison for a crime that was conducted in the face of sex trafficking and a self-defense situation, and even without those particular mitigating circumstances, we cannot allow our young people to face these kinds of sentences in this country.
Marcia Levick is Chief Legal Officer at Juvenile Law Center. Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.
And Jeree Thomas is Policy Director with the Campaign for Youth Justice. Thank you, Jeree.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.